The seventh factor I want to talk about is the distinction between risks that are knowable and risks that are not knowable. This is really several factors taken together. Part of knowability is uncertainty. Okay. How uncertain is the risk? How large is the error bar? Now, that's a factor, interestingly enough, that the public takes much more seriously than the experts. If you look at two risks, here, let's create two risks. The right side is the dangerous side. Okay. The first risk is pretty dangerous, but it's pretty well understood. The error bar is small. The second risk is probably safer. The second risk is probably safer, but the error bar is much larger. Less is known about it. Now, when the experts look at these two risks, they're going to say, well, the second one is obviously a better bet because probably things aren't going to go wrong as much. Things aren't as bad. The experts, in other words, are going to compare this point with this point. The public does something very different. The public looks at the size of these two error bars and compares the worst-case scenarios, compares this point with this point, and says, aha, this is the safer risk. And the public may be right. It turns out that worst-case scenarios happen a whole lot more often than they're supposed to happen according to the confidence limits. So the public may have some wisdom there. But whether it's wise or not, what the public is doing is worrying a whole lot more about uncertainty than the experts are. Now, even worse than uncertainty as a component of knowability is expert disagreement, what Lois Gibbs calls dueling PhDs. I think you know exactly what I mean. One expert says, I eat it for breakfast, and the other side's expert says, even thinking about it will give you cancer. And the public's response to that kind of expert disagreement is extraordinarily conservative, extraordinarily cautious. They did a wonderful study at Carnegie Mellon, and the example they used was EMF, power transmission lines. And one bunch of people read a news story, a hypothetical news story, in which all the experts quoted said power transmission lines were pretty dangerous, say 7 on a hypothetical 10-point scale. Another bunch of people read a news story where half the experts said it was 7 and half the experts said it was 3. Okay, half the experts were much less alarmed. The second story was more scary than the first story. Now, if you think about that for a minute, it's not so strange. If all the experts say it's 7, it's probably 7. If half the experts say it's 7 and half the experts say it's 3, obviously they don't know what they're doing. It might be 14. Okay? Another piece, I think, of this issue of knowability is detectability. I was at Three Mile Island. And some of you may know, there's kind of a disaster beat among reporters. So reporters at Three Mile Island were hugging each other, saying, gee, I haven't seen you since Jonestown. fairly thick-skinned people, okay? But they were frightened at Three Mile Island. It's the only time I've ever seen a room full of reporters rush a press secretary and demand to be moved further from the story, okay, which is not usually what reporters want. And I asked a reporter who'd been through wars and hurricanes and all kinds of risky situations, I said, why are you scared here? And his answer, I think, was very revealing. He said, look, at least in a war, you know you haven't been hit yet. Okay. Eloquent testimony to the undetectability of radiation in particular, but of carcinogens in general. Okay. And in fact, you'll never know whether you've been hit. Even after the latency is over and you get your cancer, it doesn't come with a tag that tells you where you got it. So whether we're talking about uncertainty, or we're talking about undetectability, or we're talking about expert disagreement, all of those are going to contribute to the knowability problem. And that, of course, in turn is going to contribute to the outrage. Now, what can you do about unknowability? Okay. Sometimes you can make the risk more knowable. Wonderful example of that was an incinerator controversy in Japan. The big issue with incinerators, of course, is temperature. You want them to burn hot enough so that they'll burn completely. And that was an issue in this particular Japanese community. And the resolution of the battle was a 7-foot neon sign on the roof of the incinerator hooked to the temperature gauge. So if a citizen wanted to know if it was burning hot enough, all she had to do was look out the window and look. Now, I happen to think that sign reduced the hazard. Okay, because I think engineers exceed tech specs less often when they do it on a 7-foot neon sign. But whether it reduced the hazard or not, clearly it reduced the outrage because citizens could find out for themselves whether the incinerator was operating correctly. OK, okay, because the risk became more detectable, that made it more knowable, that made it less a source of outrage, and that made it literally less of a risk. Similarly, when you look at uncertainty and expert disagreement, the worst one of the two is, of course, expert disagreement. Uncertainty is bad enough, expert disagreement is worse. You can often convert expert disagreement into uncertainty simply by reporting a range. And look at a typical risk controversy. Along comes a company and it says, the risk from this contamination is 10 to the minus 8. And along comes EPA, and it says, no, that's not a conservative enough calculation. We calculated it at 10 to the minus 7. And then Greenpeace sticks its oar in, and it says, no, you're both lying through your teeth. It's actually 10 to the minus 6. And people listen to that fight, is it 10 to the minus 8, 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 6, and gets a strong impression that the experts don't know what they're doing, that the risk is extremely uncertain, and therefore extremely serious. Now imagine if instead of reporting 10 to the minus 8, the company were to say something like this. Well, we think the risk is 10 to the minus 8. But we've talked to EPA, and they think it's 10 to the minus 7. We've even talked to Greenpeace. They think it's 10 to the minus 6. It's somewhere in there, 10 to the minus 6 to 10 to the minus 8. Now, if you're a risk assessor or if you're an attorney, the idea of playing fast and loose that way with two orders of magnitude sends a frisson of terror down your spine. Okay, and I understand that. But in communication terms, reporting a range takes most of the outrage out of the situation. Okay, number 8 is the distinction between risks that are controlled by the individual and risks that are controlled by the society. Okay, I like this one. This is a neat one. Okay, it's like, control is like voluntariness, but it's different. Voluntariness is who decides. Control is who implements. If, for example, your spouse asks you to go to the store and pick up some groceries, the trip to the store is not voluntary. Okay? Not in most households, anyhow. But you're still in control because you're driving. Driving is, in fact, a good example. Raise your hand if you feel safer behind the wheel than in the passenger seat. Okay, nearly all the hands are up, and that's consistent with the data. 85% of the American public consider themselves better than average drivers. And the other 15% are right. Now that's a sizable optimistic bias hooked to control. Okay, it's not just driving across a very wide range of risky behaviors. If I am in control, I feel much safer, and if you are in control, I feel less safe. Now Chauncey Starr, who used to do this kind of research for the electric power industry, has a metaphor for control that's wonderful. And I think once you hear it, you'll never forget the importance of control. What I want you to do is imagine yourself slicing a rib roast. Okay. If anyone here is a vegetarian, you can imagine slicing a large piece of tofu. Okay. That'll work too. And this is an informal occasion. You have no fork. Okay. So one hand is right on the meat, and the other hand is carving. And I want you to get a kinesthetic vision, a real picture in your head of how close to the knife the hand on the meat is as you cut. Really picture it. Okay, you got it? Now, let's make it a two-person job. Give somebody else the knife. What happens to the hand on the meat? Okay. Pulls way back, right? Either that or you get a fork. Okay. Now that's universal, so risk assessors try to make sense out of it. They say, well, the feedback loop is more complex with two cerebrums than with one cerebrum, okay, which is their quaint way of saying that it takes less time to quit cutting than it does to say, that's my finger. And that's true. Okay, but we intuitively know that's not why our hand pulls back, right? We don't think, oh dear, the feedback loop just got more complex. Okay. The reason our hand pulls back is most of us feel as long as we've got the knife, the risk to neighborhood fingers is quite low. Okay. And if somebody else has the knife, the risk to neighborhood fingers has just gone way up. Now that's true even if you give the knife to your spouse or your neighbor, to somebody you like. Now imagine giving the knife to a multinational corporation. Okay. Imagine giving the knife to a faceless bureaucratic regulatory agency. In most risk controversies between communities and companies or between communities and agencies, the company or the agency is holding the knife. The community is holding the meat. Okay. The community, in fact, feels it is the meat. And the company or agency isn't just holding the knife, it's waving it around like a chef in a Japanese restaurant saying, it's safe, it's safe, it's safe. And it is if you've got the knife. Okay? But it's a lot less safe if you've got the meat. Now, I think all of these are important. But control is so important that it's almost a contradiction to do what institutions so often try to do in risk controversies. I mean, so typically, you've got two messages to the public in a risk controversy. Your first message is, get your hands off my knife. Okay? It's my company or it's my agency. We're in charge here. We've got the expertise. We've got the mandate. We own the land. Get out. Butt out. Don't bother us. And the second message is, don't worry. Very hard to hear that second message through the outrage generated by the first. It's very hard to simultaneously disempower people and reassure them. Okay. So the reassuring message gets lost. Now, what to do about it is very straightforward, and we can all think of ways to reduce that feeling of you're in control, I'm not in control. Basically, we're talking about sharing the knife. We're talking about community advisory boards. If you look at SARA Title III, we're talking about powerful local emergency planning committees. We're talking about negotiation with environmentalists. Maybe we're talking the Valdez principles, environmentalists on your board, public environmental audits from outside auditors. It's not hard to think of ways of sharing control. The problem is that it's hard to want to share control. Nobody wants to share control. And I'm a college professor. We don't share control with students unless we have to. Nobody likes sharing control. I gave this speech a few years ago to the board of directors of the Chemical Manufacturers Association. You know, 40 chemical company CEOs in golf clothes. Okay. And they were very nice and very responsive until I got to power sharing, until I got to control. And I thought somebody was going to have a coronary. Okay. I mean, these are CEOs. They don't share control with executive vice presidents. They have pissed in the four corners of the company, and it's theirs. Okay. And if you think they're bad, talk to an audience of regulators. I mean, at least with a company, you can say, if you share control, you might make more money, and companies like money. Okay? Government agencies aren't allowed to make money. They go to jail if they make money. Okay? And all they've got is power. Okay? And if they share it, they've got less. And over their dead body, they're going to share control. Okay? But the data are very clear. Okay? That it's almost a contradiction. It's almost impossible to hold on to the control, to disempower people, and simultaneously to try to reassure them. So finding ways that you can live with to share the power is enormously important in beginning to reduce the outrage. Number 9 is the distinction between risks that are fair and risks that are unfair. Now, we've already talked about this a good deal when we talked about voluntariness, because obviously a voluntary risk is going to be fairer than a coerced risk. But that's not the only component of fairness that matters. Okay. Another one that matters a whole lot, it seems to me, is the distribution of risk versus the distribution of benefit. Companies are all the time going out to the public and saying, hey, the benefits outweigh the risks. And they're usually right. The benefits usually do outweigh the risks. But that claim turns out to be pretty irrelevant if, as so often happens, the benefits are going different places than the risks. Look, for example, at a manufacturing facility. Okay. Unless your stacks are awfully tall, the risks, whether they're large or small, are concentrated in the immediate vicinity of the plant gates. Okay. They may be big, maybe little, but they're right around in a donut around the plant gates. Unless your demographics are very weird, the benefits are not similarly concentrated. People who live near major manufacturing facilities tend to be lower in income, lower in socioeconomic status. They are more likely to be members of racial minorities. They are more likely to be victims of a wide range of environmental insults and social pathologies than the people who live further away. Okay. So when a company official goes into such a community and says, hey, the benefits outweigh the risks, he or she is right. And when the community says back, yeah, benefits for you and risks for us, the community's right. And what's important to remember here is that accurate perception from the community that the risk is not fairly distributed makes the risk a large outrage. And that makes the risk a large risk. So I am arguing that an unfair risk is by definition a big risk, okay, because it's a big outrage. Okay. What do you do about that? Well, you share the benefits in proportion to the risks, but that's a problem. You can't really go into a community and say the bad news is we're going to give you cancer, the good news is we're going to build your park. Okay. Because people will feel bribed, won't they? Okay, and they'll take the quality of the park as a good measure of how much cancer you're bringing. Okay? And the strategy will backfire. So what you wind up having to do is yoke control and fairness. Bracket those two together and go to the community and say, look, to the extent that we can reduce the risk, we will and we should and we must. To the extent that we can't reduce the risk, we are obliged to compensate you for it. What do you want? And at the point at which the community says, give us a park, at that point, the community no longer feels bribed. Now, the company at that point, or the agency at that point, may feel blackmailed. Okay? And I'm sensitive to the fact that outrage is a two-way street, and feeling blackmailed isn't a nice feeling, but I have to tell you it's a good sign. Okay? You know, when you are feeling blackmailed instead of them feeling bribed, that suggests that the power has been redistributed more equally and the fairness is being redistributed more equally, and you're well on your way to reduced outrage. Number 10 is the distinction between risks that are morally relevant and risks that are morally irrelevant. And I've written down morally irrelevant here because that's the safe side of this particular factor. Okay. Moral relevance is a little hard to grasp at first hand. Let me see if I can make sense out of it. Over the last 25 years, our society has convinced ourselves that pollution is evil. It's wrong. It's unethical. It's immoral. Now, that's a paradigm shift. That's a terribly important change in social values. It's something to be proud of. It's like deciding cannibalism is wrong, independent of the quality of the protein. Slavery is wrong, whether or not it's a good way to grow cotton. Okay, and we've similarly decided that pollution is wrong, and we've separated that moral judgment from the instrumental calculation of how much harm is being done. That's good. That's something to be proud of, but it brings a problem with it. Okay, and the problem it brings is once you've decided something is morally relevant, it's not just a matter of harm, but it's a matter of morality, the language of trade-offs becomes unusable. Trade-offs of risk against benefit, trade-offs of risk against cost, is the only rational way to talk about hazard. It is an unacceptable, immoral, callous way to talk about outrage. Okay. Let me see if I can make that clear. Let's think about child molesting. Now, somewhere in the police department, formally or informally, in order to allocate the budget, they do a cost-risk trade-off analysis on child molesting. Okay, does everybody agree? You can't allocate a budget without either on paper or casually looking at the trade-offs, how much money you can spend to reduce the number of molested children by how many children. Okay. They do that. But the chief of police never goes on television and announces, ladies and gentlemen, the optimal number of molested children for 1991 is 17. How does that sound? The optimal number of molested children. Ugh. What's the optimal number of molested children? Zero. Does that mean we fire the chief of police if any child gets molested? No. Does it mean we expect him to spend the whole budget on child molesting? No. We know perfectly well there are other priorities. We know perfectly well the budget has to get allocated and that some children will be molested. We nonetheless demand, and we mean it, this isn't hypocrisy, we demand that the chief of police endorse our moral value that no molested child is acceptable, far less optimal. Okay. He doesn't have to get to zero. He has to want to. He has to try to. He has to see his failure to get to zero as a grave moral failure, as a tragedy, as a problem. Okay. Now, in the pollution field, we haven't learned that lesson. The chief of police has, and it seems to me people responsible for environmental risk haven't. So companies are all the time going on television and saying something like this. And remember, the company is not the chief of police. It's the child molester. Okay? And it goes on TV, and it says, last year, we molested 19 children. Next year, we plan to molest 13 children. We're very proud of that record. And it would be unconscionable to expect us to molest any fewer than 13 children. Just wouldn't be cost effective. Okay. And then you kind of sit back and you wait for the Civic Virtue Awards to come rolling in. Okay. And you're genuinely bewildered when they don't. Okay. And the solution is very straightforward. It's accept the moral relevance of pollution and therefore accept that the only proper goal is zero. Now, I have to tell you, I think you'll get a lot closer to zero when you accept it as a goal than when you reject it as a goal. But that's a hazard issue, and we can leave that aside for the moment. The point I want to focus on now is in accepting it as a goal, you take seriously the moral value. Like the police chief, you don't have to get to zero. Like the police chief, you have to want to. It's the smugness with which you say anyone who thinks that we can have zero pollution is nuts. It's the smugness of that answer that makes people so angry. Police chiefs do not walk around saying anyone who thinks we can have zero molested children is nuts. Okay? They start every year wanting zero molested children, and every year they fail, and that's what you've got to do too. Number 11 is the distinction between sources who are trusted and maybe trustworthy versus sources who are not trusted and perhaps not trustworthy. Okay. Now, the first 10 were characteristics of the risk itself. Now we're moving into characteristics of the people who bring you the risk or who urge you to accept the risk. Now, I assume it comes as no surprise to this audience that industry today is not widely trusted. Okay, and that the industries that are most responsible for bringing us pollution, the chemical industry, the nuclear power industry, the petroleum industry, the waste disposal industry, they are right down there at the bottom of the trust list along with the mafia. Some would say that's a redundant list. Okay. And the rest of industry is not far higher, and for that matter, government is not far higher. Trust in regulatory agencies is asymmetrical. When a regulatory agency warns people, it is highly trusted. When an agency says, don't drink the water, people trust you. They may drink the water anyhow, but they believe you. When you say, go ahead and drink the water, nobody believes you. Okay. What that means to most people is you haven't decided yet to admit that we can't drink the water. So, you know, whether we're looking at industry or we're looking at government, trust is low, distrust is widespread. Large numbers of people believe that manufacturing industries in the United States and in Western Europe and in much of the world are capable of endangering our health, endangering our environment, and lying to us about it. And that government is either unable or unwilling to stop them. Okay. Now, I happen to think that's an accurate analysis. I think that the history of health and environment in this country has adequate evidence that, in fact, companies have been unwilling to protect us and unwilling to level with us, and that agencies have been unable or unwilling to stop them. But we don't have to agree on that. Okay? We really don't have to agree on, many of you may think it's a bum rap and the environmental protection record and health protection record of industry and government are superb. What we have to agree on is that lots of people share my sense that industry and government can't be trusted. And that has two important implications. The obvious implication is over the long haul, you're going to need to learn how to get trusted. You're going to have to build trust. That's very hard. It's not easy. It's a lot easier to lose trust than it is to build trust. And over the long haul, that's got to happen. That's the long-term implication. The short-term implication is less obvious, and I think it's more important. Okay. Given that you're not trusted, given that trust is a slender reed, and when you lean on it, it breaks, you need to stop asking to be trusted. Okay. I mean, there's a paradox about trust. The more you ask to be trusted, the less we trust you. I mean, this is so clear that the stereotype in our society of the sleazy, untrustworthy person, I don't know, the used car salesman, what does he say? Trust me. Right? You ask us to trust you, we check our wallet, we check our neighborhood for leukemia, we check our endangered species list to see what's missing, and we notch the outrage up another couple of notches. Okay? You can't afford to ask to be trusted. It backfires. Okay? So what do you ask instead? It seems to me, instead of trust, the bottom line is accountability. Okay. And many of the accountability mechanisms, I think, are very much like the control mechanisms I talked about when I talked about sharing power, sharing control. We're talking about community advisory boards. We're talking about negotiation with environmentalists. We're talking about powerful LEPCs, other institutions, so that you can assert, and this is true whether you're government, whether you're industry, whatever, wherever your role is, so that you can reliably assert to a public that isn't likely to trust you, hey, you don't have to trust us. They're looking over our shoulder. They're looking over our shoulder. They're looking over our shoulder. Don't trust us. You don't have to. And the irony, again, is the more you say that, the less you ask to be trusted, the more likely we are, in fact, to trust you. Now, the problem is not thinking of accountability mechanisms. We can do that. The problem is deciding that you, in fact, want to be accountable. Nobody likes the feeling that they can't be trusted. We all feel we can be trusted. We know ourselves to be honorable people, and I am confident that you are honorable people, and we feel we can be trusted. So we have great difficulty thinking in terms of how do I make this accountable. And any number of companies in the last several years have developed strategies for reducing their effluent, and reducing it substantially, 60, 70, 80, 90%. Most of them have not developed strategies for proving that they've done that. So what's going to happen? Along comes the XYZ Corporation, and it says, we've reduced our Sarah Title III effluent by 80%. And the community, or some community group, says, prove it. And the XYZ Corporation says, well, yeah, here's the chart. Here's our graph. See how it goes down. That's the proof. And the community, or the community group, says, well, I don't believe your chart. You cooked the data. How can I believe your chart? And you know what the company's response is? Nothing. What do you mean you don't believe my chart? You know, I'm an accredited engineer. You know, we're a multinational corporation. They don't lie. Okay? You know, to which the public's response is, yeah, sell me a bridge. Okay? So I think these companies are setting themselves up. They're doing wonderful things, they think, they claim, and I believe them, but no one else is going to believe them. Okay? And it's not hard and it's not expensive to make those improvements accountable. I mean, think about a test, a well study. You're gonna study, sample a well and find out how much carcinogen is there. Okay. Very often, you know before you start that when you come up with the results, people are gonna say, I don't believe your results. Okay. They're gonna say, you sampled in the wrong place, you sampled too high, too low, over here, over there, you didn't sample in this backyard, you didn't sample there, you sent it to a lab that can't be trusted, and anyhow, you people lie through your teeth. Why should I trust any of your numbers? Well, that's not hard to solve. You don't do the sample until you've solved that. You bring in community people, not trusting community people, but untrusting community people, the people you least want to see, the people you keep hoping you'll never see again are the ones you invite in. Okay? And you bring them in and you say, okay, let's work out now a sampling strategy that'll work. Okay? And, I mean, if trust is very low, that may mean split half, it may mean double blind, it may mean the kinds of things medical researchers do. You take six samples, I'll take six samples, and we'll send six to this lab, and we'll send six to that lab, and we won't know which lab got whose samples, and we'll get back all 12 samples, and we'll look at them, and we agree in advance with dummy tables. If the results look like this, it's serious. If the results look like this, no problem. If the results are in the middle over here, we'll agree that it's ambiguous and we're not sure whether it's a problem or not. And you do that all before you do your study, before you do your tests. And when you're all done, it may take a year, it may take a long time, but when you're done, instead of a test that you know in your heart, whatever it finds, nobody's going to buy it. Okay? You've got a test that people have got to buy. They helped you do it. Number 12 is the distinction between what I'm going to call responsive process and unresponsive process. This is the California variable. And I could take a whole hour to talk about responsive process, but we don't have an hour. So let me list just three of the most important components of process, of responsiveness. Okay. And one of them that's very important, I think, is the distinction between institutions that tell unpleasant truths proactively versus institutions that keep secrets, that withhold that information until it's finally revealed by a Freedom of Information Act complaint or a whistleblower or some other unfortunate event. Okay. Now, as a society, we are very intolerant of secrets. Okay. We can take bad news. We can't handle bad news kept secret. Where there are SARah Title III battles in the United States today, they are mostly not fueled by how large the numbers are. They are fueled by how outraged people are that the numbers were kept secret for so long. How could you have that kind of effluent year after year and not tell us? Basically, I mean, with respect to secrecy, the bottom line is very straightforward. Either you're willing to bet your life that no one will ever find out, or you're willing to bet your life that when they find out, no one will mind that you didn't tell them earlier. And if you're not willing to bet one or the other of those, you gotta tell them now. Even if it hasn't been quality controlled, even if you haven't got a 3-volume management report ready on how you're gonna solve the problem, even if your boss says, oh dear, I don't think we should talk about this, even if your lawyer says, hey, it's gonna raise liability problems, I mean, all those are good reasons. I'm not suggesting they're bad reasons. And so is sort of that old favorite, the public will be unnecessarily frightened. Those are all good reasons, but they're not good enough because the outrage that results from keeping secrets is huge. Another piece of responsive process is the distinction between apologizing for misbehavior and not apologizing for misbehavior. Just as we are a society that's unforgiving of secrets, okay, we are as a society very forgiving of the repentant sinner, but not of the unrepentant sinner, not of the weasel. And it's very important to understand that. I mean, what Exxon did wrong at Valdez, okay, far worse in my judgment than what it did to Prince William Sound, which seems to be in process of repairing itself, was Exxon's complete inability to apologize. To credibly say, I mean, they tried to apologize. They took out ads in hundreds of newspapers that were supposed to be their apology, and the ads started, a terrible thing happened to Exxon in Prince William Sound. Okay, somehow, you know, the words, we're sorry, we did a terrible thing, couldn't pass the corporate lips. Okay, and they're paying for that. They're paying very heavily for that. The experts on apologizing and on forgiveness in our society are the Catholic Church. I am not a Catholic, but my understanding is there are 5 steps to forgiveness. First, you admit that you did it. Second, you say you're sorry. Third, you try to make whole those who were damaged by your doing it. You try to compensate. You try to do something for the people you did harm to. Fourth, you promise never to do it again, or the church being reasonable, you promise to try never to do it again. And fifth and finally, and most important, you do a penance. Some kind of public humiliation that symbolizes that you did indeed screw up and that you know it. Okay. And when you've gone through those 5 steps, you're forgiven. And until you go through those 5 steps, you're not. Exxon hasn't done it. And it's not that oil spills are unforgivable. I mean, BP had an oil spill in the Long Beach area and did a superb job of cleaning up and a superb job of apologizing.